But by the time we've reached this moment of the death of God, we already have a strange change in the discourse. What new games, new festivals, what could be invented now to make up for what has already been destroyed? What myths could we construct ourselves? What games? What holy festivals? What interesting books, fascinating arguments, and new ways to live, other than the pathetic, tragic, stupid, banal array of ordinary, everyday, bourgeois, stinking life? Surely, we can do better than that.
Hello and welcome to the 204th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. The guest this week is Mark Fisher, the author of the book Capitalist Realism and Ghosts of My Life, Writings on Depression, Hauntology, and Lost Futures. Fisher is also the author of an essay about the hit television show Breaking Bad, which he wrote for the New Humanist magazine. And it's this essay which will be the subject of this week's podcast. It's Thursday, January 30th, 2014, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast. I want to thank my subscribers, Jacob L. and Andy M., for their recurring donations, and remind you that if you'd like to support the podcast, you can find the PayPal buttons at dietsoap.podomatic.com. Now, to set up this interview, I thought I'd read an excerpt from Mark Fisher's essay. Who needs religion when you have television? On soap operas, unlike in life, villainous characters almost always face their comeuppance. TV cops may now be required to have complicated private lives and dubious personal ethics, but we're seldom in any serious doubt about the differences between good and evil, and on which side of the line the maverick cop ultimately falls. The persistence of the fantasy that justice is guaranteed, a religious fantasy, wouldn't have surprised the great thinkers of modernity. Theorists such as Spinoza, Kant, Nietzsche, and Marx argued that atheism was extremely difficult to practice. It's all very well professing a lack of belief in God, but it's much harder to give up the habits of thought which assume providence, divine justice, and a secure distinction between good and evil. The music you're listening to right now is an extended version of the theme from Breaking Bad, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Mark Fisher and I discuss Breaking Bad all the way. Mark Fisher is a radical blogger, a professor of cultural analysis, and this week's guest on the Diet Soap Podcast. This time, rather than vampires, we'll be discussing the television program Breaking Bad, Capitalist Realism, and the Death of God. Mark Fisher, welcome back to Diet Soap.
Thanks, Doug. I'm glad to be back. Thanks for inviting me again.
Yeah, well, you know, you wrote an essay about Breaking Bad for the New Humanist magazine, and I, like most people I know, I'm a Breaking Bad fan, addict, so I was interested in talking about Breaking Bad with anybody who would talk to me about it.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah. So I'm glad that it's you, and I'm glad to have you on. In your essay, you put forward the idea that Breaking Bad is kind of atheist television, that it escapes the usual fantasies that are presented on TV where justice prevails and right action is guaranteed because the universe is moral. But Breaking Bad doesn't take place in a moral universe at all.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. I mean, I think that's one of the powerful things about it. I mean, one of the things I've noticed with film and television in recent years, it's a general unsatisfactory quality about the way in which both evil, in inverted commas, and madness are depicted. They seem to be able to render them in a quite a camp and pantomime way. But I mean, also beyond that problem of just an unconvincing depiction of these states. There's also the problem of persistence of a sort of naive notion of evil anyway. You know, it's a kind of master villain model of evil. What I think, as it were, there's two sort of forms of badness that we might say that emerged in television and film recently. One of which is the kind of Hannibal Lecter style madness, where which crosses over into this model of evil, really, which is just somehow the evil as this kind of voluntary decision to just, you know, cause damage or to aggrandize oneself, etc. It just isn't plausible or convincing, this model of evil. It's what I call the white cat model of evil, taken from James Bond, which itself is sort of parodied in Austin Powers, etc. But despite the Austin Powers parodies of evil, of Dr. Evil, etc., it seems to me that model of evil still remains, actually. And I think, you know, part of why I was stressing this, the atheistic dimension of Breaking Bad, is in it, really rejecting that concept of evil, rejecting the idea that there are, you know, that there are people who are ultimately bad because they decide to be bad in some way, or bad because they, derive some kind of malicious glee from being bad. What we find, I think, on a face of it, I mean, one of the great things about Breaking Bad is that the character with which we are most invited to sympathize, you know, the ostensible hero, protagonist, Walter White, is also the character who ends up doing some of the worst things in the series. But I think what's also good about the series is it resists then a simple narrative of Walt becoming evil in the sense that I described above, i.e. stepping over into this, into becoming somebody who is absolutely, we absolutely cannot sympathize with. You know, I'm stepping over, in other words, into this kind of melodramatic figure of kind of absolute alterity. This doesn't happen. I mean, Walt certainly becomes a bad person in the sense that he causes a lot of harm, suffering, but he doesn't become evil in the sense of someone with whom we can no longer identify at all, someone who has no redeeming traits whatsoever. And this is true of so I think what's powerful about that is we're not released from the tension or anxiety in respective Walt. I mean, that is in a way what I think melodrama provides us with is an easy kind of an ultimate release of tension. Okay, we know this person is bad, and we know then that we can abject them. We can't abject Walt. We can't place him somewhere distant from us, exemplar of this alleged evil. We can't do that. Moreover, I think beyond that, I think that's true of almost every other character in the series too. None of them are unredeemable. None of them are allowed to fall into this, I was going to say black and white, you know, stereotype of coming out of melodramatic tradition, really. That even the worst characters in it, even the characters of, you know, figured as kind of villains, as which would be the Nazi hillbillies. I mean, the swastika on the neck is a kind of clue that these guys aren't too nice. But at the same time, we want to, you know, the conventions of television, you know, which ultimately I think, you know, are related to melodrama. The conventions of television want us to be, you know, induce us into wanting to resolve these characters very quickly. Okay, so these are just evil bastards. But actually what we find is all of them, or the ones that we sort of see close up, even they are capable of acts of kind of mercy and kindness. So this, you know, this melodramatic and ultimately religious worldview, where we can divide the world up into good and evil, Breaking Bad absolutely won't give us the comfort of fitting into that world at all, I think. And that's what I think makes it, that's one of the reasons I think it is sort of is atheistic television.
Well, here's where the drum roll should come in, because Kant's categorical imperative is a magnificent achievement of the philosophical imagination. In the categorical imperative, Kant tries to give a single moral rule, general enough to cover all the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule, and all other decent rules, and exclude all of them that won't fit those kind of patterns. And he succeeds to an extent that I would have thought impossible. The categorical imperative is always act so that you can will the rule of your action to be a universal law. Always act so that you can will. You can will.
I've come to this position lately, or tried to figure out this position about just how to watch a movie or how to watch a television show. And it came to me when I saw the movie Skyfall, the James Bond movie. Yeah. And I realized that James Bond was changing, and that what that meant was partially that our understanding of what it meant to be masculine and what it meant to be on the side of justice was changing. And Skyfall for me is a story of how traditional ideas about masculinity and about justice and about the West and the British Empire even maybe are all continuing, despite the fact that everyone knows that it's all bunk. It's like the every single myth of the James Bond series is undermined as the movie goes along. And yet it ends up being exactly a James Bond movie. And not only that, but it just kind of rebooting the whole series and starting over at the end. And I thought to myself, you know, what James Bond's trying to do, what these movies are trying to do, is tell me who I want to be, what kind of person is the ultimate kind of person. And I think that a lot of television, and even Breaking Bad, is serving that function on some level or another. It's not even a bad thing to do, to kind of say, here's a model of how to live life. But some shows are much more honest and complicated and inquisitive, and some are more mythic and just kind of traditional and repeating the same myths again and again, and just kind of repeating the mechanism. And Breaking Bad is definitely a show that's like a little bit closer to self-conscious. It's like, we're trying to figure out how to live a life, and it's hard work.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, funny enough, I'd only recently seen Skyfall myself, and was kind of appalled by it, to be honest. I think this is the new charmless Bond, isn't it? I think we've got with Daniel Craig. It's coming something really disturbing about the Daniel Craig Bond, I think, which was somewhat mitigated by Casino Royale, I think, because of the narrative. But this new Bond, the Bond without charm, you know, the Bond without the power to seduce, like an ape in a suit, and a sort of like it's just like in a way you could read this completely against the British ruling class. This is the British ruling class, you know, with all its allure removed now, and just the kind of just brutality left in a way. It's obviously something to do with the Bourne films, I think, isn't it? Yeah, I think all of the Bourne films, I think it's Bond after Bourne, isn't it? I think that the reboot since Casino Royale, where it's, you know, it's much more physical. But then there's also this there's also this, particularly with the Skyfall, there was the Bruce Wayne intertext with the two dead parents, etc., which made me think, you know, they've got all this focus on Bond's sort of inner life in this reboot. I realized that we know almost nothing about Bond in the previous films, actually. We think we know more. We think he's a fuller character because, you know, the certain stereotypes are invoked by the actors who played Bond. But actually, we know nothing about Bond whatsoever, actually, about, you know, what his background was, what his, you know, what his parents were, et cetera, in the original films. But he's a kind of, he's a charming psychopath in those films, so we don't really notice. But because of this kind of scowling introspection of Craig, we suddenly realize, actually, and it's drawn to our attention, that how little we know about his inner life. But actually, we know, you know, much more about his inner life now than we ever did before, really.
And yet he's much more hollow of a character.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's a kind of existential thickness about Bond when he's played by Sean Connery because of the quality of the performance, not of the information we actually get, but the attenuated nature of Craig's performance, you know, strips that out, I think. So we were certainly confronted with the fact that, yeah, we don't know, but actually we never have. But yeah, I mean, I think if we bring that back then to Breaking Bad, I think, you know, you've rightly highlighted the problems of that kind of, you know, the P word has to come in here, I think, postmodernism, you know, that what is that? It's carrying on doing things where you don't believe in them anymore. And that's, you know, that's, I mean, you could say that Bond, I suppose, exemplified that from the start, you know, because of, at least when the films came out, you know, the Empire was already in crisis, as it were, as a post-colonial moment. There was already a exhausted quality about the values which Bond ostensibly represented. I mean, and that exhaustion's now gone through, you know, several more phases, I think, to have led to this this current iteration. But with Breaking Bad, I think then that the issue is, I think, you know, that is the question of, you know, who would we want to be? We might start off with that. But we're, you know, that the kind of we're left with, well, who would we want to be out of any of the characters in Breaking Bad, actually? I think we partly follow Walt through his fantasies and through the destruction of those fantasies, sort of serially, really. So we're left with, you know, we're left with a kind of vacuum at the end. You know, we still identify with Walt, I think, and we've no option but to identify with Walt, but that's an uncomfortable identification because we no longer think that Walt is a good person yet, but there's a further level of discomfort too, because we can't just then simply disavow Walt and saying well, we're wrong to identify with him at all, because, you know, even in the final episode, or perhaps especially in that final episode, you know, there are moments of real tenderness, and, you know, actually quite heartbreaking scenes with Walt and his family. The identification is still there, but you know, that's held in tension with a kind of ethical repudiation. What Walt's done repels us, yet we still identify with him. But then I think the power of that is to expose the way in which identification is produced, you know, by television, films, etc. That, you know, normally identification is produced invisibly and kind of comfortably. Here, the sort of mechanisms of identification become apparent. And
what are those mechanisms? Can you lay those out or a little bit?
But it's, I think it is to do with just that, you know, who is the character that we focus on, but also, I mean, I guess with Walt, it's that he comes from a background which is kind of multiply signaled as being ordinary, and what is ideologically taken for ordinary, which would be, in inverted commas, lower middle class. He's ordinary in this sense, connoting nothing special, not a superman, a little bit of an underachiever. Part of that is a kind of intertextual thing, particularly with Bryan Cranston playing Walt. He's carrying stuff over from, he's carrying associations over because, you know, of his role in Malcolm in the Middle as the kind of.
I have to cut in and say what one thing that happened to me while I was watching Breaking Bad is the show went along, and I'm watching it on Netflix, so I can watch multiple episodes at a time. And I got to a certain point in the series, and for me, Walter's relationship with Jesse is key for my identification with Walter. As long as he's loyal to Jesse, there's something worthwhile in Walter, I feel. And their relationship is so interesting. And it's this kind of father-son relationship that's gone terribly wrong. Much closer. They're much closer than Walter is to his real son. But anyhow, I'm watching along, and there's a point where his relationship with Jesse appears to be over, and he's just treating Jesse so shabbily, and the whole thing's going so wrong that I stopped watching the show. I could not watch the next episode. And for a couple of weeks, I watched Malcolm in the Middle instead. Yeah, it's like I still wanted to watch Bryan Cranston, but I didn't want to watch Walter White anymore. So I was watching Malcolm in the Middle on a regular basis, which I'd never even seen before. But it was, you know, extremely funny and fun to watch, but it was also this sort of like relief valve, or like, you know, basically I just wasn't man enough to keep going Breaking Bad. I had to retreat to The Simpsons or Malcolm in the Middle.
Well, did you watch those episodes eventually, or did you?
I came back.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a testament to the power of the show, really. And I think it's because, I mean, it's interesting why that is, and I think it is. I mean, we see people do horrible things all the time on TV, but they probably wouldn't have resulted in that response that you had. I think that response is because of identifying with the character and feeling that identification drain away or remain, but what you're identifying with is manifestly loathsome at a certain point. I mean, I think for many people I agree with you, and maybe we can come back to that in a minute, that the relationship with Jesse is absolutely crucial. But I think, you know, for many people, you know, a key threshold was when Walt watched Jesse's girlfriend die, which, you know, sat there and allowed her to choke to death in her sleep. At that point, you know, he seemed to be irredeemable. I think then a certain expectation was set up. This is it then. This is the end. Walt now is just going to become Mr. Evil. But that didn't happen either. I think this, you know, the series stepped back from that again because, well, you know, once again, he became sympathetic. He did sympathetic things, so we couldn't fully repudiate him, and that's part of the horrific kind of ambivalence, isn't it? Like I said, if we just had a character that had become pure evil in inverted commas, you can watch that, but a character who you still have some vestigial identification with that is doing loathsome things, but not just loathsome things, but who can flip back into being, you know, the kind of harassed everyman, which is often the sort of comedic dynamic with whenever Walt flips back into his relationship with his wife Skylar, where, you know, he becomes the, you know, from being this. At least in his own mind, and for a while in the minds of others, a kind of criminal mastermind, a builder of an empire in the outside world. Whenever he's dealing with Skylar, whenever he's put back into a domestic situation, he tends not to be able to assert himself at all. And it's this kind of this disjunction is a source of comedy, but also, I think, a source of discomfort. We'll be right back.
Yes, no, maybe. I don't know. Can you repeat the question? You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. And you're not so big. You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. And you're not so big. Life is a
Let's talk about the moral center of the show, because, I mean, despite the fact that the show is trying to discover, like, how to live, I think, and showing how difficult it is, it does start with an ideology or an idea of what makes a good life. And you wrote about it in your essay. You said that Walter White pursues an ideology of work. And could you explain that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that seems to be what drives him. And drive is, I think, the right word. We're in the space of a kind of psychoanalytic compulsion with Walt after a while. But there's an official kind of the official justification for his drive, you know, is an ideology of self-sufficiency and, you know, Protestant work ethic, ultimately, that, you know, you shouldn't depend on others. You know, one of the key early moments in the series is when Walt refuses to take help from a former business associate, a slimy character. But nonetheless, you know, a very rich character who could have funded Walt's cancer treatment without really noticing the money was going. But Walt, refuses the money, pretends to Skyler that he's taken the money. For a while, but he refuses to take it, you know, on a ground of this, what for him clearly is an ethical decision, that it's, you know, that it's wrong to take it. You should earn your own money. But this quickly becomes another source of comedy when, if this decision, ostensibly ethical decision, ends up, well, doesn't end up, the immediate solution he has to that is, oh, well, I'll become a cook of crystal meth then. So I think that this is one of the great kind of political values of the series. It's really, you know, kind of quietly but emphatically ridiculing that ethic of work that, you know, that's so built into a character like Walt that he somehow thinks that it's better to be a manufacturer of drugs than it is to accept money from somebody else, you know, because at least he's still standing on his own two feet, and at least it's the product of his own and labor. And we can see that you know, this intense focus on that as the series goes on, you know, Walt, it's more the money the money that he's earned as a sign of the work that he's done and then the success that he's had in that work, I think, rather than the money per se, which becomes fetishized by Walt. And you know that then, you know, as the series develops, then it becomes increasingly clear that the ostensible motivation for this for his criminal career, i.e. that it's to ensure that his family will be all right after his death, but, you know, that's by the end, even he has to admit that was just a facade, that there was a drive, a drive to accumulation, a drive to power,
right.
You know, a drive to really have escaped everything that he was, actually. You know, a drive to escape precisely that, you know, put upon, underachieving, you know, lower middle class persona that was where he started off from.
I mean, the thing about Breaking Bad is it's ultimately a power fantasy in the same vein as Superman. You know, you've got a guy who on the outside appears bumbling and inept and inefficient and incompetent. And then instead of that, he, you know, takes off his glasses and shaves his head and puts on his hat and voila, he's, you know, Heisenberg, not Walter White at all. It seems to me that Breaking Bad, it kind of a, I agree with you that it has this ideological take on work, that it's, at least that's the character, Walter White's original position. But the, I think the whole thing is sort of a hemmed in working class fantasy, because the way Walter White gains power is through his skilled labor. You know, his power grows and grows because of how pure the meth is and how what a great cook he is, which is just in under capitalism, that's just really ridiculous. That's not how that, certainly no meth cook is ever going to become the kingpin, you know. And but that's kind of what that lower middle class.
Yeah, but I think then, but that fantasy is can't actually with the, that there's not enough that a product is good. But I think then the relationship with Gus Fring is really interesting. Or really, perhaps even earlier than that, at the end of the first season, you know. I mean, what does Walt have to do in order to get this good product? I mean, I guess that is another level to it, the ideology, isn't it? That, as you say, really, the naive belief that good products, you know, if you make a good product, you ought to be rewarded for this. And, you know, that's...
I mean, it's undermined from the start because it's meth, right? So it's not a good product.
Yeah. That side of it. But if you do meth well, you know, then that ought to be, you know, that ought to be rewarded somehow. But of course, it's not enough for him to make a good form of meth, because not only you have to produce the stuff, you have to distribute it. And Walt becomes Heisenberg, really, in the act of shifting from being just a manufacturer of meth to actually becoming someone involved in a distribution of the product, and in a way he has to terrorize and ultimately destroy Tuco, who he refers to as a degenerate. I mean, it was just fascinating how Walt retains his kind of sense of middle class superiority despite entering into this world, or perhaps especially, you know, perhaps he has a even more having entered into it, really. But I mean, so that I think the series was presenting that fantasy, also undercuts it by, because, you know, the supplement that is needed to actually producing the high quality version of meth is all kinds of violence, etc. The only point at which there's even the remotest kind of semblance of stability in the operation is when Gus Fring is distributing the meth for him. I think the whole thing with Gus Fring is fascinating as well. You know, someone who's lives so far undercover that his life is effectively indistinguishable from that of, you know, running someone who runs a small chain of fried chicken restaurant. You know, so where is the reward? It's a weird kind of almost monastic dedication of Gus Fring. We never see him enjoying anything in respect. He's almost the anti-type of Tuco, the figure of pure enjoyment, you know, who in order to test the quality of the drug will immediately use it, whereas Gus Fring is this kind of utterly stable, sensible managerial figure whose dedication to being a kind of a dealer, a high level dealer, is such that he shows no signs of enjoyment whatsoever. I think the contrast between then between Gus and Walt becomes interesting, because Gus has almost no pathological excess. He's the pure figure of kind of managerial efficiency, whereas Walt has that kind of pathological excessive drive, which will keep destabilizing things. And also, you know, that it's not enough for him to be a sort of machine part in a smooth operation. as becomes clear throughout the series, he has to be recognized. That's a big thing, isn't it? And that's part of the ideology of work. It's not enough to just get the rewards. He has to be recognized as the genius behind it all. And, you know, there's several points in the series where that kind of hubris leads to him becoming unstuck, really.
I think one of the reasons that Walter White is appealing, and I definitely identified with him as the show started, and as you point out, I probably never stopped identifying with him, is because that drive to power and to be recognized is something that I think working class people like Walt should have more of. You know, it's I actually think that someone like Walt, or not one person like Walt, but all of us who are like Walt, really are the people who make the world. And we really ought to have more say and more power over what the world is. But Walt just isn't up to the task. You know, he thinks he's this man of decision. He thinks this man is shaping his own destiny. There's a great scene when he's coming out of cancer treatment and he's talking to a guy in the lobby, and the other guy says, you know, I just had to give up, you know, trying to control everything and recognize that things are going to happen that I can't control. And Walt just has none of that. He says, you know, you can make a decision. You know, and I just love that kind of very hyper-masculine.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of these sort of the metaphysical, I don't think, you know, Providence doesn't really survive in Breaking Bad, but I guess the metaphysical thing that does survive is fortune in lots of ways. Like, you know, because Walt is very lucky, and there's a point when, you know, and Jesse says that, I think, you know, he's really lucky. And because it's, you know, it's fortune, isn't it, that gets a good fortune that gets Walt out of lots of the situations that he's in. It isn't his own ability. You know, it's simply that he's lucky. But that itself undercuts, you know, his fantasy of being, you know, someone who's in control, who's making all the decisions. I mean, yeah, Jesse is often, but Jesse is as you said, the relationship with Jesse is the, you know, perhaps the most crucial one in the series. But it's often Jesse who will undercut Walt's grandiloquence. The hilarious scene where Walt starts to talk in the voice of someone who's doing a voiceover for an upcoming cinematic attraction. I'm in the Empire business, and then Jesse says, "Yeah, but is it that good to be in the kind of the meth Empire, Walt?" And then, you know, Jesse's role is often that, I think, and as you say, that relationship is crucial. I mean, it's so many dimensions of the series covered by it, not least comedy, really. It's kind of hilarious that, I mean, at what point does Jesse stop calling Walt Mr. White? You know, that form of deference to him as if he's still his teacher, you know, which is which carries on series after series, despite all the scrapes they've been in together, you know.
Does he ever stop calling him Mr. White? I don't think he does.
I don't think he does. I don't think he does, actually. Now I've asked the question. I don't think he does. He never gets to the point of feeling that he's equal with Walt. And that's,
well, that's the thing that was so upsetting to me watching the show, is that, you know, Walter or Mr. White never will recognize Jesse. And it's so clear that Walter wants to be recognized, that that's what's driving him. And he just doesn't give anything to this, hardly. Every once in a while, just enough to keep him, you know, at his heel. But he never supports Jesse. At times when he's really being unreasonable and ought to.
Yeah, I think it is one of the ways in which one of the most serious ways in which we measure Walt's decline. Because you could say that he's always already betrayed Skyler. You know, he's always already betrayed his family in the guise of protecting them, ultimately, in the guise of acting in their interests. Nevertheless, he's always lying to them. Whereas, you know, he's supposed to be then you'd expect him to at least be loyal to the partner who's allowed this to happen. But yeah, I mean, Jesse appears as a much better person than Walt. That becomes clear to us through the series, really. Better in the sense that, you know, without wanting to appeal to some transcendent notion of good or evil again, but, you know, someone who may well be self-destructive, but who tries to minimize the amount of harm that he causes others, really. Who, you know, is aware of the damage and destruction that he causes, that he makes serious efforts to sort of break out of his compulsive behaviors, etc., etc.
Walt, I've said it before. If you are in danger, we go to the police.
Oh, no, I don't want to hear about the police.
I do not say that lightly. I know what it could do to this family, but if it's the only real choice we have, if it's either that or you getting shot when you open your front door,
don't want to hear about the
you're
police.
Not some hardened criminal, Walt. You are in over your head. No. That's what we tell them, and that's the truth.
No, it's not the truth.
Of course it is. A school teacher, cancer, desperate for money.
Okay, we're done here.
Roped into working for, unable to even quit. You told me that yourself, Walt. Jesus, what was I thinking? Walt, please, let's both of us stop trying to justify this whole thing and admit you're in danger.
Who are you talking to right now? Who is it you think you see? Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. It disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Let's talk about Skyler for a minute.
Let's talk about Skyler, yeah.
Yeah, because now the thing about Skyler is she starts at the beginning as kind of representing the very life he wants to get away from.
Yes.
She's emasculating. You know, on his birthday, she's offering him this sort of absent-minded hand job and acting like it's a wonderful present.
Yes.
And she seems to accept the life that they have without any problem. You know, she just seems to be willing to be mediocre. I think that's the problem that he would have with her, is that she's accommodating all this, and she's the life, you know, where he's washing cars and teaching high school. She just isn't unsatisfied, and that's their you know, point of breaking, I think, right at the beginning. It's that,
yeah, I mean, I think we see her early on, you know, through his eyes, you know, in the way that you just said, really. We see, you know, see her as this, you know, in a way she's a slightly toned down version of the, you know, the Bryan Cranston's wife in Malcolm in the Middle. Again, this kind of, you know, figured as this kind of castrating figure, you know, his total dominance in the domestic sphere, and yeah, as yeah, this enabler of this kind of grey and dismal life that they have in of course that's quickly snatched away because we very quickly learn about Walt's cancer, etc. But yeah, I mean, I think the evolution of Skyler's character is very interesting. That, you know, in a way, she becomes, you know, one of the most, if not the most, interesting characters by the end of the series. I mean, it was pretty horrific what happened to the actress And Agano was subject to all kinds of misogyny, as I'm sure you know. And you know, a lot of hostility from the fans of the show towards her character. But I guess my question to them will be, what did they want her to do? What did they want Skylar to do? Just sit back and say, oh, it's okay. Yeah, fine, just get on with your life of being a meth cook. That's okay. Or do they want her to become like a kind of moll who just goes along with it? You know, or do they want her to be someone who opposes it, who totally opposes it, who tries to get him to stop? I mean, she oscillates between those two things. A position is impossible. You know, that's the issue. I think there's not so much what she does, but the position that she's starting from is impossible. She's some, you know, I think the intensity of her love for Walt actually, you know, becomes a lot clearer by the extent to which she is willing to some extent stick with him rather than straight off abandon him. And so suddenly that kind of grey mediocrity of their relationship as that peers at the start, you know, takes on a new form when Skylar is required to defend it, actually. You know, when she's required to, you know, show loyalty or not to Walt, that's when the whole relationship takes on a kind of different dimension.
With Lois and... because I've watched Malcolm in the Middle just as much as Breaking Bad, because, you know, so the difference between Skylar and Lois is that Lois is just as unhappy as Hal, in fact, more so. She's much more like Walter White, and she's also, in a lot of ways, because she's more driven and all of that. And even though she's in charge, you don't get the feeling that Hal is being castrated or emasculated by her. He's you know, this boy... man-child, and so he has to have Lois in his life, and so their relationship is different. I think with Skylar, she had to be exactly in that impossible position for this show to work. I mean, I completely agree with you. She doesn't necessarily have to be completely sympathetic either. I mean, I don't think the fan base was justified in attacking the actress at all. I think reactions to the character are maybe, you know, just inevitable.
They sort of are, but again, as I said, I mean, but even, you know, with the character, I mean, that it's odd to know what they would expect from a character like that.
Right. Well, I think they like hating her. That's what that's what she was there for.
Isn't she there then as she's there because she's crucial to the series, because otherwise it would just be a fantasy. You know, the fantasy will be able to realize itself, but she is as it were, stands in for everything that blocks the fantasy from being able to realize itself.
Right.
You know, that's why she draws all the hatred. Actually,
she's right a lot of the time, and it's not her fault. Like for the thing that comes to mind is like all the money he makes, they can't do anything with, and she's the one that's making sure they don't do anything with all this money. So she's the one who's standing in and saying, look, we're in this real world. You actually are castrated. It's not me that's doing it, but this situation is castrating. You can't realize your power. And she points that out again and again and again. And what I think is what makes her, in the end, very sympathetic is how she is broken by the experience and how her – and finally at the end, you kind of – as it goes along, you start to see what she really wants and what's important to her. And how she's castrated, she's broken by the experience too. And so I really like Skylar by the end. But at the beginning, you know, Hank and Skylar are just kind of in cahoots to make Walter White, you know, into an impotent nobody. And
I think that is part of the greatness of the series, that's the way we start off with those two characters. But by the end, you know, that they've been transformed, and Skylar's in particular, and not by some sort of wild character change. It's, as it were, just the logic of her character is only allowed to emerge in certain circumstances. You know, when everything is under threat,
right.
And you know, she is always forced to, because she's in a possible situation. You know, structurally impossible, unresolvable, then she, you know, is forced to come up with these bodged compromise solutions at every point. But I, you know, I think that's why that for me at least, she became increasingly sympathetic, because what else would you do? You know, she obviously doesn't want Walt to be a meth cook, but you know, faced with that kind of prospect, she doesn't leave him. You know, she tries to make it work. Obviously, you know, her trying to make it work will ultimately fail. And I think she sort of knows it's going to fail. But you know, she feels she has no alternative. But I mean, I think it's the increasing sort of strength of Skyler as well that as the series goes on, and particularly in the last couple of episodes, really, you know, when she, you know, definitively can stand up to Walt. The scene, I think, one of the most powerful scenes ever seen on television, when it becomes clear, you know, that when Walt Jr. learns about, you know, learns what the truth about Walt, and you know, there's a physical fight, and you know, Skyler stands up with a knife, scene highly reminiscent of the kind of The Shining for me, at least, anyway. But Skyler presenting very differently to how Wendy Torrance presents at this point. And it's not like, but it's not a kind of melodramatic strength, as it were. It's just, you know, it's a strength that's come out of sheer pain, you know, sheer pain, sheer suffering, you know, that she's had to endure this, and she's had to find the strength to actually break out of this situation, to actually, I mean, in a sense, she's in some sense, I mean, I think part of the reason people hated her was because in some sense she was a stand-in for us. You know, she was, you know, that her ambivalence towards Walt mirrors our own ambivalence towards him. And we want this resolved, as it were. We want someone to, hey, we want either someone to stand by him and enable the fantasy, or someone to step out the fantasy and say, you know, and reject it and say, this is evil, stop it. But she won't do that. She won't do either of those things. So I think, you know, some sense that her refusal to abject, or a refusal, inability, whatever, to abject Walt, reflects our own inability to abject him, actually. So, you know, in some sense, she can bear a lot of the, you know, ambivalence is an emotion that's not a feeling that's, rather, ambivalent feelings are often the most unbearable to sort of deal with. So I think in some ways we can project that ambivalence entirely onto Skyler, who bears it for us, really. And then, so there's some sense of relief, actually, at that point when she actually abjects Walt for us. You know, because she's made that decision for us. She's now saying, "Right, get out of my life. That's it. You know, you're going now. You're leaving the house." And then I think we touch on another ideology as well, which is sort of threaded through the series, which is the ideology of family. You know, where with the hilarious, I mean, it's the movement of emotion in that scene in that episode, which is the penultimate episode, isn't it? This one where you know, movement of emotion. No, I think it's Ozymandias, this episode, isn't it? I think, which is the one.
You know, I'm watching it on Netflix, so I haven't seen the last 8 episodes yet.
Oh my God, have I ruined it? But in that episode, the emotions, you know, the way it goes from something that's absolutely, you know, literally, it sort of makes you cry, to hilarity almost straight away when Walt suddenly gets up and says, "We are a family," as if that counts for anything after all this somehow. Yet, you know, the ideology of the family, you know, is also something that's, you know, constantly sort of being investigated throughout Breaking Bad. And clearly the relationship of the role of the patriarch in the family is the thing that sort of threads together the, you know, Walt's obsession with work, with the whole question of the family. Because he still wants to be the provider, you know, still wants to be in that, you know, for all that, you know, Euclid sees himself as, you know, somewhat castrated in the sort of domestic environment, you know, well, perhaps for that very reason, he still feels he has to occupy that position of provider. And, you know, that's part of what drives him on to become the Uber provider, you know, the very successful businessman, the person who exhibits the proper kind of entrepreneurial spirit, actually.
Well, you know, my final question here goes back to the question about whether or not that drive that he has could have been a positive force. I mean, obviously this show is not going to give us a story that resolves the deadlock of the problem that it starts with. It's just going to show us all the angles on the deadlock, which is perfectly legitimate. But I just wonder, could you imagine, can anyone imagine a show where someone in Walter White's position, that everyman, lower middle class, working class person who just feels their life is hollow, could you tell a story about that where they don't just get driven to like succeed on the terms of society, but to succeed in changing the terms, to shaping the terms of society themselves? You know, basically, can we imagine a revolutionary television show?
Well, the drive, you can imagine the drive. The drive, like you say, of self-overcoming, to put in Nietzschean terms, or of the drive for, you know, for Walt to be able to assert himself. The point is that, you know, he can't assert himself as a worker. He can't assert himself as a human being initially. But then he sort of goes from not being able to assert himself to this kind of crazy over-assertion. But you know that. But these problems ultimately then are, you know, class problems. You can say, or collective problems, and that the issue is whether, you know, we as a class can assert ourselves. You know, we as a class can overcome ourselves, and you know that then, you know, what form of popular entertainment can that imagine? Will be one that would break with the inevitably individualizing focus that's been kind of standard in television drama.
This isn't even $7,000, all right? My guy wants 85.
This is all the money I have in the world. You're a drug dealer. Negotiate.
You are not how I remember you from class. I mean, like, not at all.
I gotta go.
Wait, hold on. Tell me why you're doing this. Seriously.
Why do you do it?
Money? Mainly?
There you go.
Nah, come on. Man, some straight like you, giant stick up his ass, all of a sudden at age, what, 60, he's just gonna break bad?
I'm 50.
It's weird, is all, okay? It doesn't compute. Listen, if you've gone crazy or something, I mean, if you've gone crazy or depressed, I'm just saying. That's something I need to know about, okay? I mean, that affects me.
I am awake.
What?
Buy the RV. We start tomorrow.